Welcome to The Bridge, a twice-weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. Last night, the Board of Clatsop County Commissioners denied a consolidated land use application from Oregon Pipeline LLC for 41 miles of natural gas pipeline through Clatsop County. We'll hear some of the testimony from yesterday's hearing. Also on the show last week, Astoria played host to over 200 people who came to this city for the Oregon Main Street Conference. Elena Garner, executive director of the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association, talks about making Astoria a more vibrant place. Then we'll hear about the Cranberrian Fair taking place this weekend. Maria Brooks talked to one of Ilwaco's cranberry farmers. That story coming up at 9:21. This is Coast Community Radio. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. In top local and regional stories this morning, a group of Northwest scientists has weighed in on key questions related to Washington's Initiative 522, the measure to require labeling of genetically modified foods. Ruby DeLuna reports.
Washington lawmakers wanted to know more about genetically modified foods and their impact, so they turned to the Washington State Academy of Science for some answers.
Our role is to provide science-based information for the public so that more informed decisions can be made.
Tom Marsh is an agricultural economist at Washington State University. He took part in the study. On nutrition, the committee concluded that GMO foods are, quote, substantially equivalent to non-GMOs. The committee also found that there have been no documented adverse health effects from GMO foods. At the same time, it recommends continued monitoring for long-term effects. Regarding costs associated with mandatory labeling, Marsh says they vary. And it's not just the cost of labeling itself, but also the process of keeping GMO products separate from seed to production and all the way to retail.
And because many of our commodities are very homogeneous, our systems have not been constructed to segregate in all of our crops, then that's why there would be these additional segregation costs.
The report does not make any recommendation on how the public should vote on I-522. I'm Ruby DeLuna reporting.
Judging by the color of their T-shirts, foes of a coal export terminal proposed for Longview, Washington, far outnumbered supporters at a hearing last night in Vancouver. The Columbian says the fourth of five statewide hearings drew an estimated 1,000 people. As before, two well-organized groups showed up, opponents dressed in red and supporters wearing blue. The $643 million Millennium Bulk Terminals facility would export coal to Asia from the former Reynolds Aluminum smelter site on the Columbia River. Opponents are concerned about environmental risks. Supporters cite jobs and trade benefits. Washougal City Councilor Paul Greenlee said coal train traffic would cut his town in half, and the city's also concerned about coal dust and other pollution issues. Washougal resident Dave Ritchie of Laborers Union Local 335 told the hearing, quote, "We need the jobs," close quote. The fifth hearing to set the scope of the environmental impact statement is set for October 17th in Tacoma. Officials are rejecting permits for two major oil train terminals in southwest Washington after deciding the projects should face more environmental scrutiny. The State Shoreline Hearings Board issued a letter yesterday saying it plans to invalidate the permits for Westway Terminal Company and Imperium Terminal Services, which want to build oil shipping terminals at the Port of Grays Harbor that could store up to 1.5 million barrels of crude from North Dakota and Alberta. The City of Hoquiam issued the permits last spring after determining in conjunction with the State Ecology Department the proposals posed minimal threat to the environment. Groups including the Quinault Indian Nation and the Sierra Club appealed. They argued that city and state officials failed to consider the cumulative environmental impacts of having the two terminals running along with a third terminal planned for nearby. The board agreed. The board also says the effects of increased train and vessel traffic need to be considered, as does the damage that could be posed by an oil spill. After 3.5 hours of testimony and deliberation yesterday, the Board of Clatsop County Commissioners voted unanimously to reject Oregon Pipeline LLC's consolidated land use application to run 41 miles of natural gas pipeline through Clatsop County. County Senior Planner Jennifer Bunch presented point by point the staff report recommending denial of the application.
There are four reoccurring issues. One, the adequacy of public facilities and services. There is a conditional use requirement that the applicant demonstrate consistent that the use have adequate public facilities and services. And we'll have some discussion related to an emergency response plan or a similar document that is needed to ensure consistency with public facilities and services in the event of a natural gas explosion along the pipeline route. The second issue you'll see is compatibility with surrounding issues, and you'll see that in four of the zoning designations. Again, this is a conditional use requirement that the proposed use be compatible with surrounding uses. We'll probably talk quite a bit about transmission line versus a distribution line, and the applicant does that. On May 9th of 2011, the board determined that the pipeline was a transmission line and not a distribution line, and therefore is not an allowed use in the Forest 80 and the AF zones.
March 9th.
And then the fourth issue we'll talk about is a water-related, water-dependent use, what those are. Is the pipeline water-dependent? Is the pipeline water-related? And how that affects the zoning within those aquatic and the criteria within those aquatic zones.
Following Bunch's presentation, oral testimony was taken from attorneys for the applicant, Oregon Pipeline LLC, and from project opponent, Columbia Riverkeeper. Michael Connors, the applicant's attorney, did not specifically refute points of the staff report. He used his time to revisit the history of Oregon Pipeline's application process after an initial assertion the county government has no jurisdiction over the company application for a permit.
The law is clear that federal law controls here, that FERC has exclusive jurisdiction over this project pursuant to the Natural Gas Act. And that although there is a CZMA consistency process, NOAA has made very clear that that's a process for the state and that applicants aren't required to go through an application process and they're not required to get local land use approval.
Connors went on to say Oregon Pipeline had not been treated fairly in the process, that during election voter forums, commissioner candidates had made openly anti-LNG statements. He then stated that once elected, individual commissioners had engaged in inappropriate ex parte communications leading up to the reversal of a prior application approval made by a previous board.
As the process has proceeded, it has become clear that, in fact, you're not really reconsidering the former board's decision. You're reconsidering the entire application. In fact, you're ignoring the board's former decision. And so from our perspective, the difficulty and frustration is after expending all that effort and time working through this process, in a blink of an eye, all that was done away with, and now we have this new reconsideration process. And what is concerning is that since I last spoke to you, there has been additional evidence which we discovered that, in fact, the county was considering and planning the very withdrawal and reconsideration well in advance of that January 12th hearing.
Lauren Goldberg, staff attorney for Columbia Riverkeeper, also representing the Northwest Property Rights Coalition, rejected the claims of the commissioner bias and urged the commission to deny the application based on the staff report.
This afternoon's hearing is about whether Oregon LNG's pipeline application complies with county law. And as the staff report and staff presentation describe in detail, it does not.
Goldberg characterized the arguments put forth by Connors as a conspiracy theory.
Oregon LNG is going to extreme lengths to push a conspiracy theory. This evening, talking about records that they extracted from attorney fee logs. And I agree, conspiracy theories are interesting. They make for good news stories. But the reality here is that there is no conspiracy. That is, unless you consider the democratic process somehow a conspiracy. We had an election in Clatsop County, and new members were elected into public office, and I think it's fair to say that an election is about many things, not just one specific project, and there's no evidence that Oregon LNG has brought forth to indicate that that's the case here.
After testimony from both sides' attorneys, the commissioners went through a lengthy process of cleaning up language in the staff report and findings. A motion to deny the Oregon pipeline application was then put up for a vote.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say aye. That was unanimous.
Last week, the Oregon Main Street Conference brought people from towns all across Oregon together in Astoria to talk about what makes communities thrive. With me this morning in the studio is Elena Garner, the Executive Director of the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association, and we just had an Oregon Main Street Conference here last week. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we did. It was really exciting. The conference was Wednesday through Friday, and pre-registered, we had 209 participants. But I think by the end of the conference, 260 people made their way to the conference and sat in on different sessions. And it was really exciting. It was exciting for Astoria to be the host city. This year, the conference theme was Cool Cities, Old Buildings, New Attitudes. And Oregon Main Street thought Astoria really represented and embodied that. And we agreed. And it was really exciting. And it was really beneficial on all levels. Many of our board members attended. I know many downtown businesses attended, city councilors. It was just really exciting. And it was really fun.
And you were saying earlier that over 200, like 260 people that came. And
yeah.
Some of the people who came to this one had been in Astoria in the past, and they were telling you things had changed a bit since the last time.
A lot of people were really excited to see how downtown has really been progressing. And I had many people tell me that they were going to bring back their significant others and make a three-day weekend or a long weekend out of, you know, coming back to Astoria. So I think not only in terms of the educational component that the conference offered, it offered Astoria some great exposure, and people are excited, and so am I.
Did you get some reaction from some of the businesses in the downtown area?
Yeah, well, on both levels. Many that did participate that loved the conference took a lot of good information back from it, and as well as some of the conference goers shopping in downtown, they saw an impact on that as well. So, like I said, I think I'm excited on all levels for the conference, and I think the downtown businesses were as well.
Now, there were a lot of specific workshops going on, and you went to one on utilizing second story building spaces and maybe how that could be done a little bit better.
Yeah, that was a really good presentation, and it was really looking at second story spaces and how they can be used, whether for offices or residential, and really looking at the cost benefit of each and how to do them efficiently and effectively to get the biggest bang for your buck. And it was a great presentation that I believe will be online here shortly, that we can really use as a reference and look at some potential properties in downtown Astoria that we can utilize different things, whether for more office space or residential space.
So there's a fair amount of residential space right now downtown, and that
there
makes
is.
For kind of, there are usually people around. It's not a totally dead downtown.
Exactly. And that's what the presentation touched on, is really looking at more residential space, because it really creates that more 18 to 20 hour downtown feel, where people, they go to work 8 to 5, but then they come back, you know, to their downtown apartments, and then they're eating out or they're doing things. So it just creates that more lively downtown feel. And so that's what, that's what downtown's all about. It's, you want to make it this comfortable place pretty much 24/7 for people to come down and eat, shop, work, and play.
Now, you mentioned that walking tours of Astoria, not just from the participants, but from members of the public, were so popular that you might be expanding those.
Yeah. So one of the, there was 3 different walking tours offered last week during the conference. And one of them was really looking at what's been happening downtown over the past few years in terms of some second floor development and other projects around town. And one comment that I got back was that there was many local community members that were on these walking tours. And so we started talking, the Business Development Committee started talking about maybe we can expand that to doing it on a maybe quarterly basis or, you know, something like that for the community as a whole to really show what's been happening downtown, really escalating that educational piece of historic preservation downtown, but making it fun and interactive with this walking tour.
So it sounds like out of this, not only was there outreach to people outside of Astoria, but then going forward, there may be more outreach to Astoria residents
exactly.
through some of these walking
exactly.
tours.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's something that the ADHDA really tries to focus on with the four-point approach. One is the kind of educational piece of what do we do and how do we do it and how to get more people involved, because the more people that know what we're doing, the more excited they are to, you know, want to help and get involved. And then it's just kind of this ripple effect of just this exciting, you know, place to be.
And a vibrant downtown
exactly.
is good for everybody.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Well, let us know when those walking tours
Without
start taking place
yes.
and we will spread the word.
Yes. And just kind of to put a note too, we do have monthly general meetings. They're the first Friday of the month at 8:30 a.m. at Baked Alaska, and they're open to the public. And that's a good way for people to kind of start getting engaged as well if they're kind of wondering what we're doing and what we're up to. First Friday of the month, 8:30, Baked Alaska.
Okay. Well, thank you, Elena Garner, for
thank
coming
so
in and
much.
Talking to us today. Still coming up, the business of cranberry farming is big in our region, but it's also a lot of old-fashioned work.
There's a lot of hand weeding, a lot of hand work that goes into a cranberry farm. I remember a rancher coming by and seeing all of our rakes and shovels and so on, and he was really surprised. He says, you know, for a mechanized farm to have that much hand work that we do.
Coast Community Radio's Maria Brooks introduces us to the owner of one of the biggest cranberry farms on the peninsula. That story coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Rain likely today, otherwise cloudy, with highs in the mid-50s. West-northwest winds 6 to 9 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation 70%, with new precipitation amounts of less than 1/10 of an inch possible. Tonight, patchy fog after 11, otherwise mostly cloudy. Overnight lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, patchy fog before 11 a.m., otherwise partly sunny, with highs in the mid-50s. Calm winds becoming northwest 5 to 8 miles per hour in the afternoon. Then tomorrow night, a 20% chance of rain, otherwise mostly cloudy, overnight lows in the low 40s. Cranberries are big business in Southwest Washington. This weekend, a cranberry harvest festival will take place in Ilwaco. Coast Community Radio's Maria Brooks tells us about the festivities and introduces us to a man who knows the science behind the harvest.
On October 12th and 13th, the Long Beach Peninsula is hosting a fair. The locals call it the Cranberrian Fair. There will be pies and cookies and elixirs and music and even a red trolley that will carry visitors to the bogs. It's the celebration of the cranberry harvest. This little berry plays a big role in the culture and commerce of Pacific County, its adopted home. Cranberries are a native fruit of North America. The berries grow wild on the Atlantic seaboard and as far west as Minnesota. A New Englander brought vines west in 1872 after discovering the rich peat soils in parts of Oregon and Washington. At first, the berries were used in sauces and jellies to enhance a Thanksgiving meal. But in recent years, science discovered the modest cranberry possesses special properties as an antioxidant and an anti-inflammatory. The juice is consumed by many to combat urinary and bladder infections. Cranberries are nature's gift. Here in Ilwaco is one of the few places in the country where cranberries flourish under the watchful eyes of farmers like Malcolm McPhail.
I always wanted to be a farmer. Part of being your own boss and doing your own thing and making something, developing something,
Cranberry farming is mostly a family affair. McPhail and his wife Ardell and his two grown sons own Cran Mac, one of the largest cranberry farms on the peninsula. McPhail is a big man, robust in appearance, belying the fact that he's over 70. He farms a total of 122 acres.
We have four full-time employees. There's a lot of hand weeding, a lot of hand work that goes into a cranberry farm. I remember a rancher coming by and seeing all of our rakes and shovels and so on, and he was really surprised. He says, you know, for a mechanized farm to have that much handwork that we do.
McPhail grew up on a ranch in Monterey, California. He received a PhD in soil sciences from Cal Poly, but instead of farming himself, he became an advisor to farmers, working with sugar planters in Hawaii, even going to Saudi Arabia on a salt and water study. Finally, he took a job at the University of Washington's Agricultural Extension. One of his favorite regions in the state was here in Pacific County. Then over 20 years ago, McPhail left his job as an advisor and became a farmer himself.
Typically, we plant into sand, and the old way of developing a cranberry bog was to remove the top peat layer, which is could be anywhere from 2 feet to 8 feet deep. You remove the peat, and then there's sand, and you put a dredge in there, and you pump the sand out to form a nice even layer that you plant your vines into.
Tender cranberry vines should never freeze, so the bogs are irrigated. Pumps and water systems monitor the temperatures at all times. Automatic sprinklers come on at night and day whenever the temperatures fall below freezing.
Each acre has about 20 sprinklers, and you get total coverage. For frost protection, so you're getting everything covered with ice. It's a physical or a physics phenomenon that when you form ice, you release heat. As long as you're forming ice, you're protecting the vines, and and it won't get colder than 32 degrees. We only got these temperature alerts like 2 years ago. Before that, I'm up running around the middle of the night making sure everything's going.
In May, over 250 honeybee hives are hauled in by trucks to propagate McPhail's fields. Before harvesting, the square plats turn various shades of red as the bogs are flooded. Blue herons and great white egrets often perch among the vines looking for prey. With the cries of wild birds and waterfowl and bees and visiting deer from nearby woods, the cranberry farms often look like a painter's canvas.
In agriculture, in all agricultures, you have highs and lows. You've got a good price now, and then you don't have a good price. Like in the cattle business, it used to be 7-year cycles. And we're getting an oversupply now in cranberries. We're less affected being Ocean Spray. Ocean Spray is a cooperative, and it's been in existence since 1930. Ocean Spray is the processor and the marketer for our products. That's basically what they do. They take our cranberries and clean them and put them in a form that's can be sold. It's a fantastic thing, and Ocean Spray is really looked at as one of the most successful co-ops in history.
Malcolm McPhail was instrumental in preserving the Pacific Coast Cranberry Research Foundation in Long Beach. This educational facility supports the local cranberry farmers and reaches out to the community with its museum and gift shop and walking tours. The foundation also employs an agricultural botanist who studies all aspects of cranberry cultivation. The cranberry farmers of the North Coast invite the community on October 12th and 13th to visit and take a trolley tour of the bogs at harvest time. The Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum in Iwako is hosting festivities from 10 to 4 p.m. This is Maria Brooks for Coast Community Radio.
That's all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 9. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Thanks for listening this morning. We welcome your feedback on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.